Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Hello and a good Saturday to you. This is the weekend edition of the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin, and coming up after the news, electric cars are all the rage now, but do you know they've been around for over a century? We'll explain why the industry stalled and what we've learned since. Then we hear from sociologist Anthony Ocampo about his new memoir that captures what it's like to grow up brown and gay and the child of immigrants in the 90s and 2000s in Los Angeles. But first, here's a look at what's happening around LA. That's the sound of Albert Pujols of the St. Louis Cardinals hitting the 699th home run of his career last night at Dodger Stadium. The crowd was audibly excited. He hit his 700th homer one inning later, making him the fourth player in Major League Baseball history to break that record. The Cardinals beat the Dodgers 11-0. Pujols played for the Cardinals before going to the Angels from 2012 to 21, and then the Dodgers for a season before going back to the Cardinals. In other news, the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission is condemning the sheriff's search of one of its members' homes, as well as the home of County Supervisor Sheila Kuhl. Executive Director Brian Williams read the resolution.
LASD searched the homes of Commissioner Patty Giggins and Supervisor Kuhl in an attempt to besmirch their reputation and embarrass them in the press. The latest stunt by the LASD and the sheriff should be called out for what it is, a brazen abuse of power.
The department says the searches were part of an investigation into possible corruption involving a contract between Metro and a nonprofit run by Giggins. The oversight panel also called on Sheriff Alex Villanueva to disband his public corruption unit. And staying with the department, the LA County's lawyers are recommending a payment of $8 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the family of Andres Guardado, who was shot and killed by a sheriff deputy 2 years ago. The 18-year-old was killed after a brief chase near Gardena. The Board of Supervisors must first approve any settlement of the case. A state appellate court has ruled in favor of LA County against Sheriff Alex Villanueva over his attempt to rehire a deputy who had been fired for domestic violence and lying. The sheriff rehired Carl Mondoyan with back pay a few weeks after he took office in 2018. The Board of Supervisors took Villanueva to court, saying he didn't have the authority to do so. And one of the bills awaiting a signature from the governor comes from LA Assemblymember Reggie Jones-Sawyer. A member of the state's Task Force on Reparations for African Americans, Jones-Sawyer has proposed extending the duration of the committee for an additional year and to add language that allows members to be removed by their appointers. Chris Lodgson with the Coalition for a Just and Equitable California says his group is calling on Newsom to veto the bill.
This could politicize this task force. There could be people who are removed by some of the state politicians because they are supporting a type of reparations that the state politicians don't want, but the community does.
Jones-Sawyer says the change is just to give legislators the power to remove a member for offensive behavior, and that the task force's recommendations on reparations will still be ready by the June 2023 deadline. But he says the proposal will still have to go before lawmakers, at which time
the experts on this will be disbanded and won't be able to help move this through the legislative process, which I believe is probably going to be the most contentious, the most difficult part of this.
The governor has until September 30th to make a decision. Researchers at UCLA and Cal Lutheran say if U.S. Latinos were a single country, their GDP would rank as the world's fifth largest economy. They also say the U.S. Latino GDP grew faster from 2010 to 2020 than the U.S. economy as a whole. David Hayes Bautista at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health was one of the study's co-authors. He says California welcomes and invests in immigrants and has the largest Latino GDP of all 50 states.
Look at the governors of Texas and Florida. They see Latino as dysfunctional, something they don't want. But if you're interested in the future GDP of your state, you want this population. We need this population.
The study also says a 1% growth in a state's Latino population 1 year leads to a 0.4% growth in its GDP the next year. Switching gears, a longstanding art show is celebrating 50 years at the Brand Library and Art Center in Glendale. Deborah Thompson chairs the annual National Juried Exhibition of Works on Paper, which she says features both seasoned artists and first-time exhibitors.
It does give artists an opportunity to be shown, who might have few opportunities to do that. When they sell a work of art and you're a brand new artist, it's a real important step. And we are happy to offer these really skilled artists an opportunity to be seen.
In addition to this year's selection of 89 contemporary works, the anniversary exhibit includes highlights of jurors' work shown over the last 5 decades. That includes ceramic pieces from the early years before the annual event turned solely to artists working with a paper medium. The exhibit at the Brand Library and Arts Center is open Tuesdays through Saturdays. That's all the way through the end of December. Today, we are taking you to a museum in Culver City called the Venda, spelled W-E-N-D-E. It's a historical archive of the Cold War, preserving works of art, artifacts, and other personal mementos. And if you've ever wondered how a section of the Berlin Wall got to Wilshire Boulevard a few blocks east of Fairfax, it's there, courtesy of the Venda. And there's also a single panel of the wall on the corner of Culver and Combs as you approach the museum. Executive Director Justin Janpool says their exhibits capture the past, but also give context to our present.
Even as a historian, I make the mistake all the time to assume that these historic periods are bookended. You know, it's World War I, it's the interwar period, it's World War II, it's the post-war period. But the reality is things don't just start and stop. They are all sort of overlapping. The whole world is in a constant venda or change or transformation, which is why we named the museum after that ethos, that theme, that spirit of transition.
And he says some of the Venda's pieces have become more relevant with current events.
We have 4 banners here from the Ukrainian Partisan Army. These are from about 1949. And this was a particular faction that had first fought against the Germans in World War II and then turned around and fought the Red Army. These are objects that could not be more relevant today. And in fact, the symbols on these banners, the Ukrainian symbol, has become this sort of icon of resistance. We see it in the news all the time. And it is one of those things. In the first many years since the founding of the museum, people would come and say, well, like, you know, why should we care? Why does it matter? What's so interesting now is that people come in here and see something like this, and nobody really asks that anymore.
When I visited the Venda a few days ago, I asked Janpool how so many Cold War relics from other countries wound up there.
Many of the diaspora communities that came to Southern California have come from these regions and have brought these things with them to get them out. And a lot of the things here, LA has a tradition and a history of asylum. And I think in some ways, asylum for people, but also asylum for their memories that are so much embedded in these things.
As an example, he showed me a giant hand-stitched flag depicting communist leader Mao Zedong from 1968 during China's Cultural Revolution.
So many of our collections from all around the world are found right here in Southern California. This was from somebody in Orange County whose family came from China and brought that banner with them as a reminder of what they left behind. So we try to be the place where these materials can sort of live on in order to tell a story of those diaspora communities.
The Venda preserves revolutionary and subversive documents, including items from the Soviet refuseniks, Albanian political prisoners, and the Polish resistance. But there's also evidence of authoritarian rule, such as how East German border guards were trained in facial recognition. And Janpool showed me a whole mezzanine filled with spyware and other noisy antiques.
It's all turning on. This surveillance equipment all is now switching on, and you can hear and see what it would sound like and what it would look like. These are all large pieces of really heavy metal-encased equipment with dials rotating and lights blinking and with these heavy analog knobs and switches. And what we're hearing right there is an antenna. This is a East German Stasi secret police camera and TV. And these are original. We didn't change anything on this. So we're looking at ourselves, how the Stasi or the secret police would have seen us. And so there's something about just the quality of this, to see yourself in the lens of what they would be seeing, is another way that history for me really comes alive. Oh, and this is an air raid siren here. This is always fun. This is an East German air raid siren. If you wind it up, it even smells like the GDR used to smell.
In addition to archiving items found in Southern California, Janpool says the Venda is a haven for items other institutions will not preserve, such as artworks by Hungarian Jews discarded for anti-Semitic reasons even today. And in that way, and so many others, the Venda is keeping history alive. You can take a look for yourself Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays from 10 to 5. Admission is free. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
We're hearing a lot about electric vehicles as a modern-day solution to help fight climate change and pollution. But back in the early 1900s, electric cars were all the rage. So why did they fade away for so long? And what can we learn from the past as we look towards the future? Our climate emergency correspondent, Aaron Stone, has more.
Elena Cordova comes from an old-school car family. Generations of lowrider enthusiasts. I met her at the Peterson Automotive Museum in LA, where she was checking an exhibit about the new school, electric vehicles.
I heard that in California they're planning to start only selling electric vehicles. I kind of want to see how that goes, because I could see it hitting California and then spreading all over America.
Elena's right. California passed legislation this year to triple electric vehicle sales by 2026 and ban new gas-powered cars by 2035. And the Biden administration's new climate and tax law intends to push electric cars further into the mainstream. UCLA urban planning professor Adam Millard Ball says these new rides are needed to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions.
So we're not going to be able to resolve the climate crisis without electric vehicles.
40% of California's greenhouse gas emissions come from the tailpipes of trucks and cars. They're also the biggest source of LA's infamous smog. But how did we get hooked on gas cars in the first place? In the 1890s, growing American cities were overrun with traffic and pollution, mainly from horses, and the manure was literally piling up. Then a new technology emerged that seemed it could solve the problem: horseless carriages, or as we call them today, cars. And electric cars were among the first.
My name is Leslie Kendall. I am the chief historian of the Peterson Automotive Museum.
Kendall walks me through the museum's exhibit on the history of electric vehicles. The oldest ones are from the mid-1800s, and at the turn of the 20th century, they were the best-selling cars in the nation.
This is a 1908 Columbia Electric, and you can see that there's really not much to it. It's essentially what amounts to a horse-drawn carriage without the horse. You know, it kind of exemplifies what the genteel motorist of the day would drive, because they were very expensive.
Yep, electric vehicles were way too expensive back in the day, too. About three times as much as the world's first mass-produced vehicle, the Model T Ford, which also came out in 1908. Electric cars were powered by rechargeable lead-acid batteries. And for those who could afford it, they were preferable. The Model T was loud, smelly, and you had to crank it up to get it going. But electric cars, you just stepped in, pulled a lever, and hit the road. They were quiet and smooth.
They had a lot of really good points, you know, a lot of really favorable aspects. But you know, gasoline, it was cheap at first.
According to Kendall, the real game changer came in 1912 when Cadillac introduced the gasoline-powered self-starter.
All of a sudden, you know, gasoline-fueled cars just took off like crazy. Electric cars took a dive in popularity. Gasoline cars got more reliable. They got more powerful.
That changed our cities. Los Angeles widened streets, built parking spots, and prioritized freeways over mass transit. And when gas won over electricity, it drove us into another corner, worse air pollution and a climate crisis. Kendall says there wasn't money in electric vehicles, and besides a few tinkerers, automakers stopped building them. It's only in the last decade that electric vehicle technology has caught up to speed. But we may not be learning from the past, says UCLA urban planning professor Adam Millard Ball.
We're so car-centric in LA. And one thing that I think is a danger of the push for electric vehicles is we can neglect sight of the other things we can do.
He pointed to 1970s LA. Smog was so bad that it led to policies like the Clean Air Act and technology like catalytic converters. But reliance on cars has only grown and pollution remains an issue. Millard Ball says electric vehicles are needed to address the climate crisis. But what's also critical is bigger investments in sustainable transportation options that don't involve the automobile, even electric ones. Covering the climate emergency, I'm Aaron Stone.
Anthony Ocampo says growing up in L.A. in the 90s and 2000s, he often felt confused and alone. He was gay, Filipino, and the child of immigrants. Now a professor and sociologist at Cal Poly Pomona, he has a new memoir about discovering oneself in the city during that period. He joins Brian De Los Santos, host of LAist Studios' How to L.A. podcast, to talk about what he's learned over the years and to give a preview of what's inside his new book, Brown and Gay in L.A., The Lives of Immigrant Sons.
Just a quick heads up, this episode contains some strong language and depictions of trauma. If you're listening with kids, you might want to sit this one out. Welcome back to How to LA. I'm your host with the most, Brian De Los Santos. Today, we're going to try something a little bit different. I want to talk to you guys about my friend, Anthony Ocampo. Anthony is a big voice for queer people of color in LA. He's a child of immigrants, and that resonated with me because I'm queer, I'm brown, and I'm undocumented. When I found out that he was writing a book, I wanted to learn more. The book is titled Brown and Gay in LA. Sounds kind of like someone. I'm talking about myself. We went to meet up with him in Eagle Rock. This is Anthony's childhood home, where he's actually hanging out today with his boyfriend Joe and their dog Schmidt.
I lived in this house since I was 6 years old. They moved here in 87 when housing in Eagle Rock was actually affordable.
The house is a cute single-story home. Garden, flowers, trees. There's a big open space with chairs, a fireplace.
Every relative that migrated to the United States from the Philippines, this was their pit stop. There was always a new cousin or an uncle and aunt, my dad's siblings. That's kind of very immigrant-y, right?
We know LA is a city of immigrants, and Anthony is LA through and through. I know not everyone's going to identify with the story of a brown gay man in LA, but the way he navigated his queerness really resonated with me. I wanted to ask him about his experience growing up here.
I mean, I feel like I grew up like a lot of kids. Mom wants her son to like marry a nice girl and have a family so they can have grandkids. And when I talk to other queer children of immigrants, same story. I remember junior high school is the period when folks start to date and hook up. I didn't get on the bandwagon for that. Like, I always think about the situation where you ask a straight boy in junior high, like, oh, what do you think of this girl? And she's like, oh, she's hot. And you ask the gay boy and be like, oh my God, she's so pretty.
Oh my God, yes.
We all see the same thing. Oh, she's beautiful. I love her hair. But I didn't know what gay was because this was the 80s and 90s. So the only representation of gay folks was pretty much the AIDS crisis. all that I saw on TV was images of like white gay men. There was queer gay characters in Filipino TV shows that my parents were watching or my grandma would watch, but almost always there were caricatures. They couldn't live their own lives. They were just there for kind of like accessories. I think that played a role in my coming of age in the sense that I literally could not find the words to explain what was happening to me. I remember when I got to college there, I had no shortage of gay friends, gay women, gay men, but overwhelmingly, when you go into like the LGBT center, the Pride Center, all I saw were white gay folks. I looked at those friends and I thought, well, I don't see myself in them, so perhaps I'm not gay. The first time it all clicked, I met a friend who was openly gay, Mexican American, son of immigrants. We went to Circus Disco. This massive club with several dance floors. One room would be playing Spanish rock like Maná, another room would have hip hop, another would be like pop music like Britney, Katy Perry. These men looked like the men that I grew up with. And here they were like grinding up on each other, making out and embracing and holding hands. And it was just like a mind fuck. That was a time when being gay wasn't as accepted in the mainstream. We didn't really have apps like Grindr or Scruff or Tinder to easily meet men around your same location. You had to go to the clubs. We knew that the world hated us, but in this space, we could be fully ourselves. They were such iconic spaces for multiple generations of gay men of color. That's where they found community. That's where they found friends. That's where they learned about sexual health. And you could play with identities, queen out from the moment you get out of the car. It almost felt that spiritual to be there. Some of the people I interviewed basically described going to circus like going to church.
I think that's something that I identify with so much, you know, these spaces that made you feel safe, yeah. Made you feel seen, and some of these spaces were taken away. West Hollywood's makeup is different. As people have moved into LA and Southern California, the makeup of our population is different. Where are we at now with these spaces for us communities of color who are queer?
Those spaces seem like they're far and few between now. What was so important about clubs like Circus, it was part of everyone's coming of age experience. It was a place to dance. It was a place to be desired. It was a place to desire. That's where you met your first set of friends, your first boyfriend. That's where you danced when you had your first breakup. It almost feels like, oh, if you can hit up someone on your phone and meet them locally, then there's not so much of an urgent need to go to the clubs.
Anthony's talking about the end of an era. There were spaces that catered to queer people of color in LA, but as rents went up and dating apps like Grindr became more popular, these places started to disappear. Right in the middle of that transition, in 2016, Pulse happened.
I was scheduled to give a graduation speech that day at UCLA. And you know, graduation speeches are supposed to be like hopeful and go and live out your lives and dreams. And then here was this terrible, terrible experience that happened where all these young folks' lives were essentially cut off and destroyed. And it just destroyed me to know that in the one place you finally, after all these years of homophobia and people rejecting you and treating you like shit and calling you faggot, there's this one space where you could just be. And that was ripped away in an instant by a mass shooting. 49 people died that night. I'm all the way in LA, thousands of miles away from Pulse, and that incident reverberated for me too.
I actually was still awake when the news alert started coming in. I was working at the LA Times at that moment. I had my apps on, notifications on, and I was getting home. You know, it was Pride weekend, so the boys were coming over to just do a nightcap, and I started to read. And I get emotional because I saw the families, and I saw, like, two boyfriends who wanted to get married to each other, you know, and have family. And I'm like, dude, that's the story of me and my friends.
Pulse is the kind of place I would have loved to go. Those types of spaces are sacred to our community. But you know what? We make those spaces. It's not just a building. And I feel like that's the experience of being brown and gay in LA. It's creating space. And Anthony is the type of person who is always trying to create space for other people. That's what he does in academia. That's what he does at his parents' house, hosting his friends. And he does that with this book. I asked him, so what did you learn from the people that you talked to?
Let me just start with the personal. Full stop. I just needed to hear those stories because I had no blueprint for myself for how to navigate what it's like to be a gay son of immigrants. These men may be under the same category, but there's a plethora of different experiences. I wanted to write a book that reminded people of what these young men experienced. Not that I wanted to harp on the trauma, but I wanted folks to remember that even if we have same-sex marriage or whatever, you know, love Victor on TV, which I love, by the way, it doesn't erase the fact that gay folks experience trauma. Some of the folks I interviewed said when they came out of the closet, their parent drove them to Mexico, dropped them off in their hometown, took away their passport so they couldn't come back so that they could get straightened out. I wanted to write about that stuff in a way that would honor the fact that those experiences were real, despite the fact that things are, quote unquote, getting better.
Anthony's book, Brown and Gay in LA, came out September 19th. This is How to LA from LES Studios. I'm Brian De Los Santos. Catch us Tuesdays through Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at les.com/howtoLA. That's it for today, y'all. I'll catch y'all soon.
Hey, thanks for listening to the weekend edition of the LA Report. We'll be back tomorrow with more of what's happening around LA. Until then, try to take it easy. I'm Julia Paskin.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.